year certainly started with that unsettling false missile alert. Now, 6 months later, there is work underway to improve our systems for communicating with underserved communities during a disaster. We talked to Francine Wai with the Disabilities and Communications Access Board about what's being done.
One of the concerns that we had was a large number of individuals indicated that they were not able to receive appropriate communication about the false missile alert, and particularly about the fact that the alert was indeed false, so that while other people were more quickly notified through traditional media such as television, there were no sign language interpreters nor other means to let the deaf and hard of hearing community know that, in fact, it was a false alert. So we did some follow-up on that, and clearly there were some gaps that are trying to be addressed at the moment. Because of that, and because many deaf people contacted FEMA, we have been working with FEMA in the interim, and they will be here in August to do a number of workshops, or maybe you might want to call them roundtables or training sessions. So on Saturday, August 18th, FEMA's sign language or ASL interpreter will be working with interpreters in our community here who are ASL interpreters about providing ASL services during emergencies.
So that's a good thing.
That's very positive, and we're offering that as continuing education credits for ASL interpreters here. Then the following week, we are having four workshops that are going to be statewide. On the 21st, it will be on Oahu, the 22nd on Kauai, the 23rd on Maui, and the 23rd will be on the Big Island, the 24th will be on Maui. And they are considered roundtable discussions where FEMA will be conducting, I would not say it's an assessment, but it would be an open roundtable discussion to obtain information from the disability community. So this is not limited to people who are deaf and hard of hearing, but it's limited to the entire disability community, and to glean what they can from the difficulties that people had from notification to evacuation to, and the evacuation portion, of course, will be more significant for people that are on Kauai and the Big Island because many of them have been displaced. They have issues related to shelter and recovery. So our staff as well as the FEMA staff will be participating and inviting people to these discussions.
Right. So when you're talking disabilities, you mentioned, yeah, not just the deaf and hard of hearing, but if you're visually impaired.
That's right. Anybody whose disability was a factor in either how they received information, how they were notified, their ability to access a shelter, receive information, receive any accommodations, all of that would be discussed at the roundtables,
right.
Plural.
And this was really a learning experience for everybody to say, okay, we were flat-footed on this. This didn't work, that didn't work, and how can we improve going forward?
Right.
And this, I understand, will also be the subject of an upcoming conference.
Yes. That conference is sponsored by a different agency than ours. It's the Office of Language Access. And on August 1st, they will be having their full-day conference on language access, and they will be speaking particularly about language access in emergencies. So in addition to our concern, which would typically be the deaf and hard of hearing community, they will be talking about all foreign language and limited English-speaking populations, how they were notified and and what kind of services are available.
So we're really drilling down. I mean,
yeah.
Just from the broader community, who had access to phones, who had access to radio or TV, and then the folks with special needs that weren't addressed, that were kind of left out of the chain of communication?
Depending upon your disability, yes, they were left out. And I think that the purpose of all these meetings is to use the January incident as a starting off point, but not necessarily to critique only that incident, because there are many types of emergencies, and that was only one specific type. Kauai had its own flooding. There are other situations with the volcano, potential hurricanes. So I don't believe that any of these discussions wants to belabor just January 13th, but really wants to look at more systemic approaches to which agencies can do what in various types of emergency situations.
And let's talk about the deaf community for a second, because I know with the advent of cell phones and texting, there was some thought that their sign language skills were getting rusty because people were so glued to their phones and so glued to their messages. So how do we look at that?
I don't think that there's any disagreement that people are becoming more glued to their phone, and I don't think that's limited to the deaf and hard of hearing population, although the ability to text perhaps plays a bigger percentage or bigger role in the life of people who don't have verbal communication skills, not skills, but means that are typically available to the broader population. But I don't really believe that is caused any diminishing of ASL skills. Social media has perhaps diminished a lot of people's writing and other skills, but that's not limited to people who only have ASL as a language. It's a preferred go-to source for immediate information, but most of the ongoing information about emergencies tends to be sort of a 24/7 ongoing stream of information that comes across through TV and through live streaming, for example. So we're looking at not only texting, which can tell you, yes, an emergency is happening, or do A, B, and C, but all of the dialogue that comes along with understanding the status of an emergency and what to do often comes from television. And there are a lot of people who are deaf and hard of hearing who will use television because of the proliferation of televisions with required closed captioning built in, and more entertainment and news being captioned. Because the response, a disaster, whether you talk about notification, response, or recovery, is so layered between the county, the departments of emergency management, state, Hawaii emergency management agency, FEMA, plus all of the other agencies that get pulled in, from Red Cross to, the governor's office or the mayor's office. It's very difficult to find, I wouldn't say accountability, but find a home for many of the tasks that need to be done.
That was Francine Wai of the Disability and Communications Access Board talking about efforts to improve communications with members of the disabled community during disasters. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we hear from the Office of Language Access that is focusing on disaster response for those with limited English skills. But first, it's time for your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we take you back to the 80s when mullets and big hair were the rage of fashionistas who sported extreme shoulder pads, lace, and lycra. We're thinking of a local beauty who appeared on the small screen with roles on Hawaii Five-O, Magnum P.I., and Dallas. Our mystery actress was also an accomplished athlete and competitor. She was a 1978 Hawaii State Girls Singles Tennis Champion and won the title and crowns for Miss Hawaii National Teenager and Miss Hawaii USA. She pinged the national radar by placing fourth on the Miss USA pageant in 1981, and then a year later appeared on the Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. In the 90s, she pioneered the role of Kristen Forrester Dominguez on the CBS soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. She would go on to carve out a pop career in Europe and released a couple of albums, earning a huge fan base in Finland and Italy. For today's quiz, can you tell us who this super achiever is? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, I'm Mel Chin from Egypt Township, North Carolina. You can hear The Conversation live anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Coming up next week is that conference aimed to improve communication during a disaster for those who don't speak English. The Office of Language Access is hosting the one-day conference to determine how can we do a better job at serving those with limited English skills during natural or man-made disasters. Now, the office was first created back in 2007 to help serve a large cross-section of immigrants throughout the islands. We talked with the director of the office, Aparak Barungrun, about this need to help the segment of our community.
We just want to make sure we're looking at the need and the requirement of the language access in the disaster. And we also, another objective is how to address the access need in the emergency. And we also looking, identified the community resource for the LEP population, because different community, they might prefer the way to receive information. Like, for example, people from Chinese community, they might go to their community leader.
And so what were you hearing? What was the feedback when you reached out to members of the non-English-speaking community?
Well, the thing is just the same concern. Everyone says that, oh, we don't know how to communicate. We don't know what the resource we should go to. We don't understand what's going on. So we want to know what should we do in that situation.
Right, whether it's a missile and you have to get out of harm's way, or whether it's a tsunami where you might have to also move quickly?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, that information that we receive. And then, okay, what is the next step? What happened? What should we do? Where should we go? That we want our conference this year to serve as a forum for information exchange and for the communities and agency to come together and to see if it's is there any resource that we can share, or we can working like a collaborate and looking for idea and way that we can help to better serve our LEP community?
And are you looking at other cities where there might be some models that we could learn from?
Okay, that's a great point, because now the keynote speaker, she is the consultant from California. She lives in San Francisco. Her name is Susan Fru. She used to work for FEMA, and since in 1990, and she moved to the private sector in 1999. The interesting thing about Susan, she has a strong tie with Hawaii. She worked in Hawaii from 2009 until 2014 on Maui. And she has worked well with State of Hawaii and as well as throughout the U.S., Asia Pacific, and Southeast Asia. So we're going to learn from her what different perspective can see what is the trend from the different jurisdictions.
And to see what they're doing in San Francisco. She's from the Bay Area then?
That's correct.
I see. So who do you hope to attend this conference?
Okay, so far, because we want to be inclusive as well as diversity, we expect about 300 people. We are looking for like a state and local government worker, like a state agency, city and county. We also have service provider from nonprofit and private sector. We also have people who register now for medical field as well as an interpreter and translator and community leader, like for the leader from Micronesian communities. I think it's about a good time. The timing is better that we revisit the issue. Something's going on. Like I say, now it's August and the first 2 months of hurricane season. And it's also the incident that happened, like you mentioned, the missile alert, as well as the flooding on Kauai and the volcano eruption on the Big Island. So it's really, the theme this year, I believe, is really timely.
That was Eprek Barumgrun talking about the conference to be held August 1st at the East-West Center. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio, HPR 1.
Aloha, this is Tim Delaney, President of the National Council of Nonprofits. If you want to listen back to a show, visit The Conversation at hawaiipublicradio.org.
PRI's The World Listens.
2042, according to census figures, is the year when white people will be the minority.
So I'm just wondering, is there going to be a Y2K moment on January 1st, 2043? Like, what's going to happen? I'm Marco Werman. Join us and hear the world.
This afternoon at 1.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad Blair's on the line with us with more on the attack ads that we're seeing these days. Morning, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, a lot more just in the last week, I think.
Well, you know, the primary, August 11th, is quick approaching, and the campaigns are trying to get out their messages. I think these ads, particularly one of them that's airing on behalf of a super PAC that is supporting Colleen Hanabusa for governor, really takes David Ige, the governor, to task over the false missile alert. And there's also an attack ad from Hanabusa's camp and another ad that some perceive as an attack ad from Ige against Hanabusa. They are fast and furious, and they are all over television news and YouTube and the Internet.
And so what kind of effect will these things have, you think?
Research shows that as much as people say they don't like negative advertising or attack ads, they tend to work. They tend to persuade voters, at least those perhaps who are undecided. And there are, according to the most recent polls, a number of people undecided in the governor's race. And we're talking, of course, the Democratic primary here. I think the one that's running from Be Change Now, the super PAC aligned with the Carpenters Union, the one that was so heavy opposing Ben Cayetano a few years back. Remember Kirk Caldwell? They were running for Honolulu mayor, and
right.
PRP is what it was called back then, Pacific Resource Partnership. But Be Changed Now is throwing a heck of a lot of money. The ad they have up is called 38 Minutes, and anybody who was in Hawaii on January the 13th of this year remembers the 38 minutes in which it appeared falsely that a ballistic missile was headed our way, and it was a pretty dramatic experience, to put it mildly. Well, the ad, and you can watch it yourself, it's up on our website, it's just about everywhere, all over TV, It looks like it's even been mailed to media, including Civil Beat. It depicts the governor as just being clueless, really out of his depth. It keeps saying, he didn't know his Twitter account, as if having a Twitter account would stop people from freaking out. Although I have heard from folks who say, you know, if they pay close attention to social media, that would, in fact, comfort them. But bottom line, it shows the governor as being out of his depth, and certainly underscores Hanabusa's argument that we need leadership. Hanabusa, of course, has nothing to do with his ad. The super PACs cannot coordinate directly with the candidates they're endorsing.
Right, but I think your article noted that the governor's Twitter account really only had, I don't know, maybe what, 10,000 followers?
Yeah, and I'm one of them, and okay. You know, maybe I would have been comforted. I actually found out from someone else that morning that it was a false alarm. I'm also one of those people that didn't believe it actually was the real thing. But as you know, many people did, and it was pretty traumatic. So that's the ad on the missile attack. We'll see whether it works or not. An ad coming from – go ahead, Catherine. Please.
No, I mentioned this before, but in traveling this summer, I, you know, stopped off in New York and Chicago, and just at the airport was just kind of floored at the negative ads that I saw in the races in those cities. And I was like, ooh, I'm glad, you know, we aren't that vicious here in Honolulu, but I don't know.
I think, in fact, we're not all that different. We could look at two elections passed locally. There have been some pretty tough ads. I think the ones against Cayetano in the mayor's race were particularly unfortunate. But, you know, this is a pretty tough ad. I think it is entirely appropriate to criticize David Ige over his response to the missile. Colleen Hanabusa certainly has made it a centerpiece. But, of course, the question is, will it actually sway voters?
Right. And what other ads did you look at?
Yeah, so there is an ad from the Hanabusa campaign that is raising concerns about the number of housing units that were created under the Ige administration. The governor has said, both on his campaign website and his election website, that it's 5,300 units that have been created since he's been governor. The Hanabusa ad actually runs a list and says, oh, no, a lot of that stuff started beforehand, before Ige got into office. And a number of those projects, by the way, are renovations, not creating new units. So I checked around, and yes, actually some of the criticism from Hanabusa's ad does bear out. I don't have the precise numbers, but you probably saw the Star Advertiser cover this morning. Sophie Koch is looking into those numbers as well. Governor Abercrombie, who preceded David Ige, is on record as saying, no, a lot of that stuff started when I was governor. So the ad's argument is false claims. It's effective in the sense that it's undercutting Governor Ige in one of his top priorities, and in his mind, one of his top accomplishments, putting more people into housing. And so, by the way, the administration stands by the numbers, but you can look at the ad in yourself and decide whether it holds up or not.
Right, so we'll be expecting to see maybe a few more ads before the primary rolls around.
I don't think that's any doubt at all. And my guess is there will be more negative ads, attack ads, whatever you want to call them, a lot less of the rosy, glowing ads that you saw early on in the election cycle. Some of those are still floating around.
Okay, Chad, thanks. And keep watching those ads.
Oh, I will. Thanks, Catherine. Bye-bye.
Right. That was Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor, Chad Blair, with today's Reality Check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, a dangerous and deadly heat wave grips the globe. We'll look at where and why it's happening. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
Imagine taking on the largest insurance company in the world. We have reaction today to a lava-related lawsuit filed against Lloyd's of London by Big Island resident. The eruption at Kilauea has been disrupting life in Puna for almost 3 months. So far, some 700 homes have been destroyed. Many more have been abandoned due to unsafe conditions and lack of access. Living in the lava zone is risky. Some get insurance, but many don't. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty shares the story of one family's dilemma as it tries to file a claim after paying out to Lloyd's of London over the last 6 years.
The Leilani Estates home of Philip and Lynelle Haysmer was destroyed by fire in mid-May. The property was covered through Lloyd's of London, the world's largest insurer. But 2 months later, the couple has still not received a payout on their claim. This week, the Haysmers filed suit against Lloyd's, alleging a breach of contract. Jeffrey Foster is their lawyer.
This is a company that collected, I believe if my math is correct and my conversion is correct, $44 billion in premiums last year. Okay? $44 billion they collected from people. They collected millions from folks in Pune. Okay? And what did the folks in Pune get for those millions of dollars in premiums? They got nothing. My clients have yet to receive $1 from Lloyd's of London, the biggest insurer in the world.
Lloyd's was one of the few options for homeowners insurance available to residents of Lava Zones 1 and 2. Russell Ruderman is the state senator representing Pune at the legislature.
So the reason we're hearing Lloyd's of London is because in Lava Zone 1 in particular, it's very difficult to get homeowners insurance. Some people are able to find that with normal carriers, and others cannot and have to go to Lloyd's of London, which is, you know, an insurer of extreme cases. And they are actually, from what I understand, not licensed as an insurance company in Hawaii. So they perhaps are a little less regulated than some others. And a lot of people's policies, whether it's Lloyd's or others, have had something called a lava exclusion, because that's the only way they would give them the policy in that zone. So therefore, it becomes important whether, you know, whether it burned or was covered by lava, and if you can prove that it burned and wasn't covered by lava. Now, in a lot of cases, people who have had insurance have had trouble having it be paid for a variety of reasons. Sometimes something like this, the insurance company wants to use some loophole. In other cases, there's a lot of funny categories where some people, their home still exists, but they cannot get to it. And in the cases like that, even with some more ordinary companies, we've seen the denial of payment. So there's a lot of folks in limbo in this in regard to homeowners insurance because of a variety of these circumstances relating to lava. Some folks have a home that will never be accessible. Some folks have one that might be accessible someday. And some, of course, are gone. So that there's a range of categories. And the insurance companies aren't going to reimburse you if they can avoid it for a home that's still there. So while that's not what happened in this case, there's so many people having a variety of issues with their homeowners insurance at the time, of course, when we most desperately need them to come through for us.
Have residents experienced these type of insurance problems in previous eruptive events?
I doubt it, because there really hasn't been one. This whole Lava Zone 1 insurance concept really came along in the late 80s and the early 90s. And that's when they started having those exclusions. And there hasn't been lava inundation of homes since that time. So I think we're experiencing it for the first time now.
And have any of your constituents contacted you about issues they've experienced with insurance, homeowners, or otherwise?
Dozens, yes. It's one of the very common frustrations and questions, you know, because a lot of people are just fallen in some kind of limbo. They can't go home, and they can't prove that they can't go home. Maybe they're not allowed to get home, but their insurance company doesn't care what civil defense says. It says it's still there. So, we get contacted every day numerous times on this subject.
One point made in the Haysmers lawsuit is that Lloyd's of London is not licensed by the state to actually sell insurance in Hawaii. The company is what's known as a surplus line or non-admitted carrier. Gordon Ito is the insurance commissioner for the state of Hawaii. He explains how that limits the state's power to regulate Lloyd's.
We have what we call authorized companies that do file for a certificate of authority. They submit an application. They have to meet solvency requirements and other requirements that we require to be admitted. Lloyd's of London, within the regulatory framework, also what we call surplus lines or non-admitted, are carriers that write on excess basis, or you and I, as individuals, could independently procure for a surplus lines carrier. Those surplus lines carrier within the law do not have any guarantee fund protection, and there's very limited regulatory oversight that we have over surplus lines or non-admitted carriers, and Lloyd's of London is one. With respect to the LAVA exclusion, we're aware that I believe, depending on which Lloyd's syndicate or group wrote that policy, there are some Lloyd's policy that do not have that LAVA exclusion, and there are policies that have that LAVA exclusion.
And what is a LAVA exclusion?
Well, the language that I've seen basically say any loss caused directly or indirectly by LAVA would be excluded for coverage.
Okay. So that means if your house is impacted directly by LAVA, it's not covered, or even if there's a LAVA bomb hits your house or a fire gets started in the forest and then your house burns down, then you're not covered.
Well, I mean, that's what the language states, but, you know, again, well, the, you know, the insurance division does not engage in contractual interpretation. We're not the agency that makes that determination as to what's included or excluded by language within a policy.
Okay. And the lawsuit filed alleges that Lloyd's of London is not licensed to operate within the state of Hawaii. And you mentioned just a moment ago that because of the type of insurance company they are, there are fewer regulations on them here. Can you comment, are they operating lawfully in the state of Hawaii in your, as far as your office is concerned?
Well, so going back to my initial comments in terms of the application for certificate of authority, again, Lloyd's of London did not go through that certificate of authority process. So in a sense, yes, they're not licensed, but within the, again, regulatory framework, non-admitted or surplus lines companies like Lloyd's can sell policies in the state under certain conditions defined under what we call Article 8 of our insurance code. So although they're not licensed, again, within the parameters of Article 8, they can sell insurance within the state. And the two basic frameworks with respect to how someone can procure insurance from an unauthorized or surplus lines company is, one, you and I can independently procure a policy from a surplus lines company, but the, you know, again, are not protected by any guarantee fund. So if they go insolvent, there's no guarantee fund protection. The other, as I mentioned, significant difference is that they're not subject to general regulatory provisions within our code or solvency provisions. So we have very limited, the insurance division have very limited oversight over those non-admitted companies.
And it's my understanding that Lloyd's is one of the few options available to residents in LAVA Zone 1. Can you comment on that?
Well, there's the entity called HPIA, which my understanding was riding in LAVA Zones 1 and 2. So that was their option. That option was available up to a policy limit of $250,000. But again, you know, it's an individual's choice whether to buy from HPIA or from another admitted carrier or authorized carrier. Or, you know, you can, again, independently procure surplus lines on your own under Article 8, or you can procure it through a surplus lines broker if there's, for the most part, no availability. When you refer to the term surplus lines, is a lot of times, I won't say a lot of times, but there are cases where you can get so much coverage. Like, for example, HPIA only limits or offers a limit, a policy limit, up to $350,000. Hmm. But say your house or your home replacement value is $1 million, you know, and you want to cover the full $1 million value, then that's where we talk about surplus. It's over and above what you could get in an admitted market where that's available.
Okay. And so if for anyone out there listening who may be in this situation and they're having trouble with the with that insurance company or any other one, what should they do?
Well, they're always welcome to file, you know, a complaint with our office, and we'll do an investigation. Even though the surplus lines company has, you know, we have limited jurisdiction, I mean, under Article 8, they have to be in compliance with, you know, applicable laws in the state.
So you do still have some measure of control over them?
Very limited oversight over surplus lines carriers.
So going forward, then, if you're considering taking out a policy with one of those carriers, then it's buyer beware.
Yeah, I encourage all the consumers and homeowners or insurers to really to look and understand the difference between an authorized company and the protections, like the guarantee fund that's offered versus the unauthorized insurers and surplus lines law within our code and the limitations that we have.
Despite the challenges, not all homeowners in Pune have experienced as much difficulty getting a claim reimbursed. The East Hawaii real estate market is currently booming, with displaced residents seeking to replace destroyed homes. Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And to get help from the State Department of Commerce and Consumer Affairs, visit the agency's insurance page at cca.hawaii.gov.
Aloha, I'm Craig Jenkins, a storyteller from London, England. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In the show, we told you about a local athlete and beauty queen. She was 1981's Miss Hawaii USA. She went on to place fourth at the Miss USA Age pageant. Recognized for her print, commercial, and TV work, this Punahou alum was a schoolmate of President Barack Obama. Both graduated in 1979. She lettered in 11 varsity sports and was a two-time All-State Hawaii Women's Tennis Champion. Her numerous television appearances included roles on Magnum P.I., Hill Street Blues, and Dallas. She pursued music in the 90s, and her second album, Be Young, Be Foolish, Be Happy, released under the Warner's Record Finland label, went gold on the European charts. However, Terry Ann Lynn may be best remembered for pioneering the role of Kristen Forrester Dominguez, the oldest daughter of Eric and Stephanie Forrester, on the CBS soap opera The Bold and the Beautiful. Nobody got that today. We stumped you. But that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
On the next Fresh Air, who is Maria Butina? The 29-year-old Russian woman has been charged with working as an unregistered agent of Russia in the U.S. We'll talk with Washington Post investigative reporter Rosalind Helderman about Butina's political connections, her relationship with the NRA, and her activities related to the 2016 U.S. election. Join us.
This afternoon at 3.
For the past year, all eyes have been on a rare plant high up in the Waianae Mountains. A camera and other special sensors has been mounted monitoring life around this plant 24/7. The project is being showcased at the conference of the Hawaii Conservation Alliance this week, and just weeks ago, that camera went live online. Lucas Fortini with the U.S. Geological Service Pacific Islands Ecosystems Research Center sat down with us to talk about this groundbreaking project.
Fundamentally, here in Hawaii, when we deal with conservation issues, one bedrock issue that we always stumble upon is the issue that there's kind of a disconnect between where people live down here and where a lot of these super critically endangered species live up above in Te Wawakua. So this is essentially an effort for us to create a connection between people down here and these plants that really need us to think a little bit more about them. So there's this public engagement part, but the name itself is a misnomer because Plant Cam is not only a camera. The plants we're monitoring up there are probably the most well-monitored wild plants in the world. We have sensors monitoring its growth, local climate, soil conditions, bird and animal visits, and we're really coming up with the information that can hopefully help managers that are managing these rare species better understand what are the threats and what are the conditions that maybe these plants can thrive.
So what is the plant that we're focused on?
This is a Ciania calycina. It's a critically endangered plant. Last assessment they did for the species, they counted less than 200 individuals anywhere on the island. Probably that's an overestimate. I wouldn't be surprised if the numbers of actually wild plants now is a lot lower.
And so tell us, where is this plant located and how is the camera mounted?
Yes, so this is on the southern part of the Waianae Range. So actually it's nice because if you're down here in Honolulu in traffic or wherever, you can look up in the mountains and you can realize that up there's just these incredible still native forests and there's a lot of conservation efforts that go into making those forests still native when it's still a home for a lot of these incredibly rare species. And it's, yes, the deployment of this whole project out there was certainly challenging because we're talking about, you know, very steep ridges and gulches and so forth. We had to helicopter drop all of our equipment on top of a very narrow ridge and working at conditions that, it was very exciting.
And cliffhanging. Right?
Exactly. And just the amount of cabling and equipment that we had, it was kind of ridiculous. But we managed to get it all up and running, and it was great.
And so the big thing is that you folks have been monitoring this plant now for about a year, but now it's all online.
Yes, it is all online. And so people can go to this website, plantcam.live. And they can see actually real-time the images. Every day there's new time lapses generated automatically for the last few days because, you know, plants don't move around and dance around like, bald eagles and other critter cams and so forth. But so we make these time lapses so you actually can see the plant growing over time along with the data in terms of like, you know, the precipitation data, temperature, and all of these things that you can actually understand, start getting an idea of like how these plants are really reacting to its own environment.
So some people might think, oh, that's boring. You're watching grass grow and there's not much that goes on to warrant a camera.
Oh, it's been a drama. It's been incredible. We've been getting a lot of data in terms of what we have, the time lapses that kind of course, condense the timeline into a more, let's say, a human timeline. A few months ago, for instance, we had one of the few invasive plants that still were in that area, a Brazilian pepper tree, just rolled down the hill and pretty much almost obliterated this, you know, unique plant. And, you know, because of the system, we were able to run up there and rescue the plant. Actually, one of the stems, we were able to hike out of the mountain and take to Lion Arboretum where they have a plant propagation lab. And they now, we have this, we were able to even save this stem as a now a different plant. And all thanks to their, you know, great propagative work. So that's just one thing that happened.
Able to react quickly then?
Yes, exactly, because of the system. The other thing is, you know, we've been monitoring animals that have been visiting potential pollinators. Up to now, we really didn't have a good idea of what could potentially pollinate it because we have lost so many of the native birds up in these forests. And we were really pleasantly surprised that we saw a lot of birds visiting once it flowered just about a month ago. We have been just getting great images and real-time lapses of the plant going through its full flowering period, which is just incredible. Nobody ever saw a Ciania or a Lobelia flowering, you know, from start to finish. Just some incredible imagery that also has scientific value as well.
So explain to our listeners what this plant looks like.
So let's see. It's this plant, it has several stems, and kind of at the top, there are these really long and very thick leaves that are thick and on a roll, kind of a roll around it. And it just has these beautiful flowers that are purple bluish, and they have very long flower tubes or corollas. And those is and the reason for that is that they were co-evolved with all the native honeycreeper forest birds that, you know, such as Eevee and others that have these very long peaks, beaks that they used to collect the nectar for these plants. So they're just incredible. Nowhere else in this world. They actually have arrived in these islands. This lineage of plants, they have been in these islands for over 13 million years. So essentially, the descendants of these plants, the one single arrival that happened 13 million years ago, they arrived even before Oahu existed, and they're still here. So it's, you know, people think of rare plants as these kind of delicate beings, but, you know, these are survivors. They've been around in the earth for over 70 times as long as humans have, just on this island.
And so with that one branch that you were able to propagate, and that's at the Lion Arboretum, and so what's going to happen to it there?
So what I would really like to happen is, again, we have the science component of this project. We're really being able to understand better about, you know, what are the environmental conditions that these plants seem to enjoy most. So ideally, after it goes through its recovery period, because it was severe trauma, it was pretty much chopped at the base. Once it's ready for transplant, I would love to be able to actually utilize the data from our project to determine, okay, should we put it back exactly where it was? Or perhaps does it need a place that needs a little bit more light? Or maybe a little bit, a place where maybe soil moisture is a little bit better during drier conditions during the summer. So we will be able to actually use the data to not only put this plant back out in the wild, but also we are trying to collect fruit and seeds from the same plant and others around to have keiki to outplant. And with this data, we're going to be able to better decide what are those places that they are, have a better chance of surviving.
And is there a concern, I don't know about pests, but do we have the pigs rooting around up there?
Yes. Thankfully, this area is protected. It's fenced. But yeah, for a lot of these lobelioids, cyanias and other species, related species, they are, pigs and are a huge problem. So they do get munched on if there's pigs around.
Right, but it's safeguarded.
It's safeguarded for now.
And any other surprises with the cams and the critters that came along? I mean, I don't know, you know, how good the optics are. We're able to get, like, I don't know, like you said, the pollinators. You know, what are we? What types of things are we talking about?
Yeah, so we did see, for instance, so like I mentioned, we have lost, unfortunately, Eevee out on this island, and Akielo, and many other birds that that used to pollinate this plant. So in this area, thankfully, there's still plenty of Amakihi, Apapane, and Elepayo, and the three native bird species that are still present here, forest bird species. So we did see a lot of visits from Amakihi visiting, and that was pleasant because it's this plant is kind of hanging on a steep gulch, kind of down below the ridge where a lot of the birds concentrate their activities. You know, there's a lot of ohia up on the ridges, and they like to ohia a lot as well. So it was very interesting once we got the data, and we saw just an incredible shots, by the way, of these birds just, like, you know, perching over the flowers and so forth.
And so what's the elevation that this is located at, roughly?
Probably about, good question. I think maybe 2,500 to 3,000. Yeah, I think 2,500. Yeah, it's high up there, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, but that's exciting. So so you have a window into the world of this endangered plant, and now we can all go online and kind of share in its story.
Yeah, and so you can go to the site, it's plantcam.live, and we do recognize that even with the data and the time lapses, sometimes there's not much going on, but if you subscribe to the site, every so often, once a week, a couple of weeks, you'll get some notification about something exciting that has happened with the plant. And it's, so it's always something going on, always some different efforts, or sometimes there are some updates about the different conservation efforts that are going around the plant. So not only you learn about the plant, but all the people and all the incredible effort that takes to really preserve these incredible places that make Hawaii for what it is.
And so you mentioned this is the first of its kind, this camera. So what's the plan to expand?
Yeah, so actually we're working with a student, an engineering student now, to try to essentially come up with an equivalent monitoring system that is a lot smaller and a lot cheaper, because obviously the data we're getting is useful in terms of management, and we've already been learning so much about this plant that it would be great to use that for other rare plants, because essentially for so many of these plants, that native plants that we have now, they're so rare that it just we can study them in conventional approaches. A lot of ways you study like plants, you have a large plot with a lot of plants and you monitor them over time. Well, what happens if you have a population that has like two individuals? You can't use conventional methods. So we feel like we can really make this monitoring system a lot cheaper, a lot simpler and smaller for us to really be able to replicate across different rare species, across different populations, and really start getting a better idea about the biology of these plants that right now we are left to kind of guess a lot of times.
All right. Well, that's great news. But thank you for sharing this story, and good luck with the expansion project.
Great. Thank you.
That was Lucas Fortini, USGS research ecologist, with the latest on the battle to save the last of only 200 rare native plants using a monitoring system that includes a camera. Find out more, including links to the plant cam, on the Conversation's Facebook page.
In recent months, it's become a familiar story. A powerful man brought down by accusations of sexual harassment and assault.
And one of the actresses took me aside and said, hey, try not to be alone with him.
We take a closer look at one of these stories and ask a simple question. Why now?
Women especially used to watch other women report and not be heard.
This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we'll be sitting down with the head of the Democrat and Republican parties as the primary election is just around the corner. Tell us what's on your mind. How can we build a more robust democracy in a state historically dominated by one party? Call our talkback line. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and on Twitter, HI Conversation. If you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under HPR News and Talk for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.